from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in the hour ahead, wildlife has been offering a lot of surprises lately. Humpback whales have been wowing onlookers along the San Francisco Bay with their spectacular leaps. Several gray wolves have been seen along the Oregon border, and California's only known wild wolverine was spotted in the Tahoe National Forest. Naturalist and adventure travel guide Michael Ellis joins us to talk about natural happenings, local and global. Ellis is just back from Brazil's Pantanal, where he saw elusive jaguars and endangered giant river otters. And he'll also share stories of his recent travels in Tanzania, Bhutan, and Ecuador, and provide advice of what to see and experience both locally and beyond. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. San Francisco-based eco-travel guide Michael Ellis joins us in studio for this Forum hour. He's actually Bay Area-based, and he's been leading fauna and flora sighting trips both locally and across the globe since he started his guided tour company, Footloose Forays, back in 1984. Michael Ellis has also been contributing to KQED's Perspective since 1988, which I think puts him in the longest trajectory.
Amen.
And he writes a regular column for Bay Nature magazine, is on the board of LandPath, a Sonoma County nonprofit dedicated to enabling people access to land in nature. Welcome back to the Forum program. I can't believe it's been 2 years since you've been on.
I know. You hear that? 2 years. Anyway, I got to send a Twitter account right now. Do you mind if I take a minute to do that?
He's doing your own tweeting. He's also got some comic spirit to him. As for those of you who don't know who Michael Ellis is, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Let's talk about something that's very much in the news now. Record number. We're going to talk about global stuff because I know you just got back from Brazil, and we're going to cover really a whole wide range of things here in this hour. But I want to talk about humpback whales first because I saw the headline, a thrill boaters who are seeing them, but a worry of biologists. Why are they all showing up suddenly? They're eating anchovies?
Well, it's great because remember Humphrey came into the bay twice, but he was lost and misplaced. And then later than that, there were two cow-calf pairs, Delta and Dawn, who came in, but they too were lost. And this is the first time we've actually seen humpback whales inside the bay feeding, which
it's normal for gray whales to come in, right?
Occasionally it is, yeah. But they're also misplaced because they're not really feeding when they're on their migratory route. They just come into San Francisco Bay because they're a bit misplaced. But right now it appears like there's large, humpback whales eat anchovies and krill, and apparently the anchovies are in San Francisco Bay in fairly good numbers. And the other thing which is good news is when I first started watching whales, leading whale watching trips in the late 70s, the estimates for humpback whales in the North Pacific was 2,000, okay? Now there's 21,000 humpback whales. And by the way, the last whale killed along the coast of California out by the Farallon Islands was a humpback whale, and it was shipped to Richmond where it was made into dog food. So you can see how our attitude toward these magnificent animals has changed through time. So the pictures are spectacular where you have these lunge-feeding whales, and in the background is the Transamerica building. I mean, that's really special. And again, they're charismatic organisms. So anytime they can get people on their side, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I want to talk with you a bit about whales. But before we do that, it's not only whales that are coming back in number, harbor porpoises too.
Yes. And my friend Bill Keener started the Golden Gate Cetacean Research Group because he noted on his job going into San Francisco, harbor porpoises. We'd done trips together many years out to the Farallons, whale watching trips, and we'd seen harbor porpoises offshore. But starting probably about 5 or 6 years ago, he started seeing a large number of harbor porpoises moving into San Francisco Bay. And that's continued to this day. They're doing really well.
But also, except when they meet bottlenose dolphins. Yeah.
Oh, well, exactly. The bottlenose dolphins, that may be related to a warming trend in the Pacific Ocean where bottlenose dolphins showed up in San Francisco Bay, which occasionally kill harbor porpoises, and also have been moving further north along the coast of California, further north than they've ever been seen before. There's a handful of these bottlenose dolphins that are individually identified. So researchers, when they get photographs, can go, oh, yeah, we know those guys. Last time we saw them was off the coast of Monterey 2 months ago. exciting.
So where's the best place to go see the whales, first of all?
Apparently, Alcatraz, somewhere in San Francisco Bay. My friend Bill, the guy I referenced earlier, he took some fantastic pictures from the bridge right down onto the whales. And I think KQED used some of those photographs in an article that they did on humpback whales. But normally, you know, you have to go all the way out to the Farallon Islands. And I do a couple of trips there a year. I used to do many, many, many. Now I just do a couple. But the Farallon Islands, of course, is a wonderful venue for seeing whales, and also the Farallon Islands, and just, you know, learning a little bit about the furthest western part of the city and county of San Francisco, which are the Farallon Islands.
We're talking to Michael Ellis, and we're going to, of course, invite you, our listeners, to join us in conversation here, but also looking for hints of things to see, fauna or flora, or looking for places to hike. This is a man, and he's always reliable on that score, more than reliable. He's one of the enlightened.
But actually what I like about the show is that the listening audience calls in with a lot of ideas, and that's always fun for me.
I was just going to say, they give you ideas.
Exactly.
Let's talk. We want to get back to the Bay Area, but let's talk globally, because I know you were just in Brazil, and there's lots to see in Brazil. A lot of things, for example, I didn't know you could see crocodiles in Brazil?
Yes.
Tigers in Brazil?
Well, caimans, actually, which is in the same group as alligators. There are crocodiles further north. But where I was, there's in the Pantanal, which is the largest wetland in the world, just to put it in perspective, it's the size of the Great Central Valley of California, which is the size of Great Britain. So we're talking a massive wetland, even bigger than the Okavango Delta.
It's the size of Portugal, I think.
It's huge. Yeah. And within this, believe it or not, are 10 million caimans, which is a remarkable number of caimans. So those are easy to see there. It was very exciting to be back in Brazil. I hadn't been there in 9 years, and things – Brazil is a fascinating –
Except
fascinating.
People are afraid to go there because of Zika.
That's true. There's also – I mean, you know, it's a calculated risk. Everything is. I mean, if I wasn't planning on becoming pregnant, and relatively speaking, the Zika virus is more benign than a lot of other things you can get on international third world tropical travel.
Well, those caimans are extraordinary in size. I mean, you know, you can almost mistake them for some other kind of reptile that is bigger.
Those guys aren't nearly as dangerous as the black caiman, which actually gets a lot larger. Those caimans in the Pantanal are quite shy. You can walk right toward them and they'll just disappear into the water.
And you saw jaguars there also?
Oh, and that's the thing that's really changed in the 9 years. The jaguar sightings that I had when I did previous trips were tracks. That was it. I'd been going into the neotropics where jaguar country is since 1984. I'd never seen one. And this time we saw 8 individual jaguars in 2.5 days. And what they've done is they've gotten the jaguar down. The jaguars are now comfortable with the boats, and the boat operators, there's a huge burgeoning ecotourism tour there to see jaguars. It's a little bit reminiscent of what I call predator jams in East Africa, where when you have a leopard sighting, everybody lets everybody else know that the leopard is there. But the benefit of that is the shared information is that everybody has this incredible experience to see one of the, I think, the most beautiful cat, certainly in the Americas, up close. And clearly we're not affecting its behavior, which is really nice. And I'm always cognizant of, well, what role are human beings playing? Are our actions detrimental to the behavior of the animal? And it appears that's not the case here. But, you know, it was off the chart amazing.
I always like your amazement and your awe at the things you see. I still think, though, if I'm not mistaken, Tanzania for you is the best wildlife show anywhere. But you've been traveling so many different places. When I think about it, you know, Ecuador, Bhutan, any place left to go?
But I don't necessarily want to take a group of people there. I just want to go on my own. I'd love to go to Papua New Guinea, to Borneo. I'd love to see Lake Baikal. I'd love to go to the Gobi Desert. I'd like to go back to Paris. I love New York City, but I don't want to take groups of people there. There's a whole bunch of places I want to go.
There's a lot of wildlife in New York City you could actually go on an excursion and be a tour guide for. But let me get back to whales with you, because
sure.
Reading this fascinating article, I think it was on your website, about the whales being asleep and awake at the same time.
Oh, yeah. That was fascinating. Well, I write this column called Ask the Naturalist column for Bay Nature magazine. And it's great because, you know, the reading audience writes in and they ask these questions. And so basically the questions were, how do marine mammals sleep? And I had a personal encounter with a gray whale years ago off of Half Moon Bay that just appeared to be going up to the surface, taking a shallow breath and dropping back down for 90 seconds, coming back up, breathing, and dropping back down. So a lot of the research has been done. Obviously, we're conscious. We're involuntary breathers. When we go to sleep, we don't have to think, oh, I need to breathe. Whereas marine mammals, because they inhabit a watery environment, they have to have at least portion of their brain awake. And that's apparently what researchers have found when they've done analysis on the brainwave activity of marine mammals, especially dolphins, which have been most of the ones in captivity that have been able to done research on. Essentially, what they find is that half of the hemisphere of the brain rests and goes into a slow, deep sleep where there's certain repair mechanisms that occur. And then the other half of the brain stays awake for potential predators, ships, whatever. And then the other half switches and the other half of the brain gets to sleep. So it's
called USWS.
Yeah. I can't remember what unihemispheric
slow wave sleep.
Slow. And it's not like REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, which is so there's basically two kinds of sleep in mammals, non-REM and REM. So apparently these animals don't have REM sleep.
But they have REM sleep in both hemispheres.
No, they have they just have the slow repair.
They have no REM sleep at all?
Uh-uh.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. And some of the seals also have the same thing?
Yeah. And it's interesting because eared seals and true seals, which are two different kinds of seals, both have a common ancestor, have different sleep patterns. And when they're on land, they don't have to worry about it. So they can go into regular REM sleep, apparently.
You were talking about a personal experience with a whale. What happened with you and do I have this right? Near-death experience with a buffalo?
I've had two of those. So Cape buffaloes and hippos are the most dangerous animals in Africa, and they're responsible for more deaths, besides mosquitoes carrying malaria, than any other animal. And so basically I was behaving inappropriately by going up to this rock outcropping to text my sweetie who lived way back in California. And a Cape buffalo came charging out of the bushes right at me. And my sort of reptilian stem fight or flight brain took over immediately. I ran down and hid behind one of the staff's tents, hoping that the buffalo would not come down through the tent. But if it did, at least it'd have to go through a tent to get to me. But fortunately for me, the buffalo ran off into the bushes. But I'll never forget the sound of the bushes being obliterated by this charging animal. It's my fault, actually.
Boy, it makes me think of, you know, that Hemingway story, The Short Happy Life of Francis McComber.
I do.
We're talking about Michael Ellis. He's here with us in studio, an opportunity for you to not only ask questions about fauna and flora, wildlife, humpback whales, but also questions about where to go to see them. I mean, several gray wolves have been seen along the Oregon border, and California's only known wild wolverine was spotted in the Tahoe National Forest. So there's lots to talk about here in terms of our own geographical center of activity. But also, as Michael alluded to earlier, we love to hear recommendations from you, our listeners, of things that you've seen in the world of wildlife or the world of fauna and flora. So give us a call. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and you can call us now. Always when Michael's on, lots of people with questions and lots of people with recommendations, so feel free to join us. Again, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum. I'd love to hear particularly from some of you who have seen something recently, seen some form of animal life or been somewhere where you were taken by the topography or you were taken by at least the sight of nature and taken in by nature is a good way, or commune with nature. I remember the old Woody Allen line, I'm two with nature, but we're talking about things that you see or you observe or you experience. You can also, of course, email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. In fact, here's Dick who writes, we've got two red-shouldered hawks in our neighborhood that are calling almost constantly early morning and in the evening. What's going on?
They must be reinforcing their pair bond, you know, because they are monogamous and they do tend to mate for life. And so they're all or they could be feeding young. And I'm not sure which those also could be begging young. So it's July. Yeah. Well, they ought to be gone by now. But, you know, it's the Bay Area. So they have rebound kids. They come back and live in the nest when they're supposed to be gone.
Well, there's this whole remember we did a show about just all of the wildlife now that one sees in the urban settings. I mean, it's become kind of a whole area of study unto itself.
Well, it's wonderful. Anything that's semi-wild that can exist with all the changes we've wrought across the landscape is my kind of organism.
And speaking about wild, can we talk for a moment about wildflowers? Because they're on display, I know, in the Sierra Nevada, but they've been reported as being pretty spectacular and also just about everywhere now.
Well, yeah. I've had a couple of friends that have just returned from the northern Sierra Nevada. And, of course, the wonderful thing about California, among many wonderful things, is if you like flowers, you know, they basically start blooming from February all the way through the end of August, and you can just go up in elevation. So right now in the Sierra Nevada at about 7,000 feet is a spectacular – at least in the northern Sierra Nevada. It's going to be different in the southern Sierra Nevada – is a spectacular wildflower display that has to do with the benefit of all the water and the snow that we got this year. So I wouldn't hesitate if you were making plans to go up there is to go and see it because it hasn't been like this for a couple of years. And, of course, the desert this year was one of the super blooms, which was really fantastic as well.
Well, let's go to our caller. Let's get Kevin on first here. Kevin, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Just yesterday I was up in Quincy, California. It's the county seat of Plumas County. And I saw two eagles flying, and I was walking through a dense pine forest, and all of a sudden this big eagle exploded out of a tree. I guess I scared it. And it seemed huge, just really big. And I was wondering, what's the best way to identify male or female? Are the females like less colorful than the males, like with ducks and other birds?
That's a good question. For most birds of prey, there's very little sexual dimorphism. That is, the physical appearance looks the same, except for the fact that the females tend to be slightly larger than the males. That being said, that's kind of hard to see when you see one by itself. But when you see two together, you can see that the female is slightly bigger than the male. And also the plumage patterns vary on the larger birds of prey, and it may take 3 or 4 years for them to get to full adult plumage, so they can be a little bit confusing, not confusing to them, but confusing to you. And we have, of course, two species of eagles in California, the bald eagle and the golden eagle. And up at Quincy, you could have seen either one, I mean, because there's plenty of water around there, which where nesting bald eagles are, but also the wild country would support the golden eagles as well. And the golden eagles are slightly larger than the bald eagles, but you scared them and they probably startled you, so I think you're even.
And thank you, Kevin, for the call. Let me go next to Michael, who is joining us from San Francisco. Michael, your wife has a fear of you were looking for an explanation about dogs. Looking at another caller here who has a wife who's afraid of whales. Maybe we can help him later on, but these are two Michaels. This Michael's from San Francisco. Dolphins and whales and how long they stay under water, that's what you want to find out?
Yeah, I was recently in Belize and was able to see some bottlenose dolphins and was just curious if you can give a brief layman's explanation of their remarkable ability to stay underwater with lungs for so long.
Yeah, no, that's great, and I'll be happy to do that. Well, first of all, you know, obviously they're mammals, therefore air breathing. And so there is something, at least for deep diving whales and dolphins and porpoises, that's called the mammalian diving reflex, which is basically when the animals are about to sound, that is, go below the surface. And of course, to back up a little bit, bottlenose dolphins are not deep divers, but something like bottlenose whales or sperm whales routinely go down to 5 to 10,000 feet, which is really spectacular. So at any rate, they have a myohemoglobin, which is a kind of molecule that's present in the muscle tissue, which binds more oxygen than our hemoglobin does. So the oxygen is right in the muscle tissue. So when the animal goes to dive, it exhales, actually, because you don't want collapsible soft spaces in your body when you're underneath those tremendous pressures. The heart rate slows to 1 or 2 beats per minute. The flow of blood decreases. It only coats the heart, the lungs, and the brain, the essential things. So no longer is the blood being delivered via the circulatory system, but the oxygen is sitting there right in the muscle tissue. So the animal can dive way down and spend 15 minutes to an hour at depth. Obviously, when you're if you run out of oxygen, there's the in at least land mammals, you have a buildup of carbon dioxide that crosses the blood-brain barrier that causes your brain to want to breathe, because it's not a lack of oxygen. It's the buildup of carbon dioxide that causes you to want to breathe. Whereas dolphins and whales, they don't have that same reflex. You can also burn glucose, your fuel, in the absence of oxygen. And what happens when that happens, it's very inefficient, but it burns up, it creates lactic acid, which poisons your body. Whales, dolphins, and porpoises deep diving can tolerate huge levels of lactic acid without a side effect. Then they come up to the surface, and then they totally, some of them have to spend a while at the surface rebuilding their oxygen debt.
So, Michael, you wanted a lucid lay explanation. You got it.
Hey, that was pretty good, wasn't it?
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. We're talking to Michael Ellis, naturalist, wilderness guide with Footloose Forays. That's his company, started many years ago. Talk about, you know, when I look at your website, I always learn new stuff. 25 miles off the, he was talking about Bolinas, but 25 miles right off of the Marin coast, you got the largest seabird colony in the contiguous United States.
That's the Farallon Islands, yeah, the Southeast Farallon Islands and the Mid Farallons and the North Farallons. The organization called, formerly known as Point Reyes Bird Observatory, now called Point Blue, has been under contract with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service since 1969 to monitor the recolonization, the seabirds, the sharks.
They just had a big anniversary, which we celebrated, sort of. We had them on.
Oh, good. Yeah, they're really wonderful people. And, it is the largest seabird colony south of Alaska, so it's really spectacular. And this year, I actually talked to Russ Bradley, who's one of the biologists out there, to see how things were going out there. And he said it's a sort of a mediocre year. There's been some success and some failures, but
I saw that you described it as a mediocre year for birds.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's a tweet from Deborah. She wants to know, regarding marine mammals' sleep, since they sleep a hemisphere at a time, do they sleep twice as long as we do?
No, they don't. That's a good question. And remember, a lot of these things are just known from animals in captivity. So the presumption is that you can extrapolate that to wild animals or to baleen whales. So a lot of this research has been done with bottlenose dolphins, by the way, that our gentleman saw off Belize. Flipper, if you remember from the 60s movie.
Of course.
So you extrapolate to baleen whales and make the assumption. But 4 hours at a time seems to be – so that's 8 hours. So it's comparable to human beings.
I wanted to also say, you know, I talked about sightings of wolves or a wolf or two really up around Oregon, but in Lassen County there was a wolf sighting as well. I just wanted to get that in there. Could you talk – we're getting up on a break here, but could you talk a little bit about beavers being involved in watershed restoration? They're our allies in that.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a movement to spread beavers up and down California, which would be great because it is the they can restore the watersheds and – sort of save water, create habitat for salmon and a number of other organisms. And the researchers, the biologists who came in and started sensing beavers in the 1930s were sensing a population that was greatly deprivated by trappers. And so basically they were looking at a depauperate population of beavers and they said, hey, we never had beavers in the San Francisco Bay Area. But that appears to not be true. Beavers at one time were really widespread through the state of California. And because of the demand, especially for the beaver felt hats in Europe, when the trappers came in to like Jedediah Smith in 1825, they were here to trap the beavers. The Hudson Bay Fur Company coming down from Oregon, they were trapping the beavers as well. So they basically wiped all the beavers out. So by the time the biologists were really looking at distribution of beavers, they weren't really where they originally were.
We're talking to Michael Ellis, and if you have questions for him or you have recommendations for best places to see wildlife or wildflowers, let us know your best sightings and favorite spots. Any questions you have also are welcome. Give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum. And Jessica writes, I was in Half Moon Bay over the weekend. I was surprised to see all the humpbacks feeding. They were so close to shore that you could just sit on the beach and watch the show. Amazing to see.
Hallelujah.
Welcome back to Forum. We're talking with naturalist and wilderness guide Michael Ellis. And please give us a call. Our phone number, Toll-free, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. And you can also email questions to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Also looking for your recommendations of places to see wildlife or great places of nature here in our own backyard or really anywhere on the globe, since that's where Footloose Forays and Michael Ellis travel. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Here's Vince, who writes, "My daughter and I have always wondered why the local vultures in our Sebastopol neighborhood," I think he's talking about the bird. No, he says, "why they circle above a found meal. It seems counterintuitive that the ones in flight would advertise to other vultures that there is a meal to be had and hence invite more competition."
What a great question. Well, first of all, Darwin did an elegant experiment when he was in South America on condors, black vultures, and turkey vultures. And he hit a sheep carcass underneath a blanket, and the condors could not find it, nor could the black vultures find the decomposing sheep carcass. However, the turkey vultures could. So turkey vultures are one of the few birds with a well-developed sense of smell. And so they find their prey, if you will, by the sense of smell. And so it's hard if you're a turkey vulture to find something and all by yourself. And so apparently through time, evolution has encouraged collective sharing of discovered food. So it's beneficial to the species as a whole for them to rotate around in these thermals to let other vultures know to come.
All goes back to Darwin, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Well, here's another listener. It says, "at Chrissy Field this past weekend, there was what I thought was a sea lion hanging out right off the shore, but other people kept saying it's a seal. A seal versus sea lion? What's the difference?"
Oh, well, that's a good question. Sea lions are called eared seals, and the name indicates that they have an external ear flap. Okay. True seals, which is harbor seals and elephant seals that we have here, have an opening and a hole in the side of their head, but no ear flaps. Their movements through the water are different. Sea lions, eared seals, use their fore flippers, their front flippers, to swim through the water. They use their rear flippers as rudders, whereas true seals, elephant seals, harbor seals, use their rear flippers in a side-to-side motion and use their fore flippers just as guides or rudders. And their movement on shore is different. Eared seals, sea lions, can pull their rear flippers up underneath them and undulate and are quite acrobatic on land. Therefore, they're the true circus seals. And the true seals have to undulate like worms on the sand.
Your seals are different in terms of sleeping, again, what we were talking about before. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the interesting thing is they used to believe that they came from two different stocks of animals. Mammals that had returned to the sea in a different time, different place. But now, due to a lot of the DNA work that's being done, they find that they actually have a common ancestor, these two.
And we have a lot of callers. Let's go to them. Peter, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I guess I don't have much of a question. It's more of a cautionary tale, I suppose. But I live in San Francisco in the Glen Park area. And I've always seen the signs for the coyotes and kind of taking them with a grain of salt. But one day we were out for our walk, and Estella lost his dog, and I guess it had changed, or started chasing the coyotes, and they kind of lured it into the bush. It was really sad. So after that, I kept my dog on a leash, but one day we saw one, and it was funny. As I'm filming this guy, he's sitting at the head of the trail, and he's slowly going up the trail. As I'm filming him, two or three more just pop out of the bush, it just scares me. And so, they're really adept at, at picking off dogs there. And I guess that's my comment is, it's kind of amazing how they've, it doesn't take much to trick a dog, but I guess people should heed those signs.
Depends on the breed, I would say.
Yeah, it's fair enough. But I guess, because even I, being a cautious dog owner, kind of the signs, and you kind of just look at them and, don't think about it. But they're really on a predator, and that, people should take more caution.
Yeah, they can be scary. I'm glad you brought that up. And there are more of them around, aren't there, Michael?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I love the fact that a native canid dog is thriving in and around human beings, even if they're picking off occasional small, yappy little obnoxious dogs.
Whoops. But how do you really feel?
Did I say that out loud?
Well, but people want to be concerned about those yappy little dogs, because they love them and so forth.
Oh, no, yeah, exactly. Well, obviously you should keep your dog on a leash, and, the coyotes, they're surviving the best that they can. But, yeah, of course, if you have a pet, it's like a member of the family. So I was just kidding.
Yeah, Peter, thanks for bringing that up. Appreciate that. I know you were kidding. Let's get Don on next. Don, you're on.
Hi. I was one of four kayakers that were going around Angel Island Sunday before last that ran into those whales, and one of our people in the group, Lorinda, who's really good with a camera, was able to get a lot of the great pictures you saw on television.
Actually, we have a link up to that video, Don. Thank you for bringing it up. It's on our website.
When you mean, I was in Brazil at the time. When you mean ran into, was this a metaphor or did you run?
It was very, we felt pretty, I paddled with whales quite a bit down in around Half Moon Bay and everything. But these were well-defined feeding patterns, and there was on one side of a very well-defined tide line. And they would come up to the tide line, and they would just come out of the water, and Lorinda with her telephoto lens on that camera, I'm amazed that she could get those shots. I just have pictures of the sky and the water, but she's good at it.
Oh, that's great. I'd love to look at that.
Yeah, well, it's on our website now. Thanks to Judy and Amanda, kqed.org/forum. Thank you for that story, Don. That's Don from Vallejo, encountering a whale in a kayak with three other people. Let's get Arlene on next. Arlene, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi. I had a couple of questions. One was about those bridges that they're talking about putting in so that they can have more diversity between the lions and other species, or they're being cut off by the freeways.
Wildlife, wildlife corridors, essentially. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And are there any that you know of being planned around here, and what do you think of them?
Oh, well,
One more question, which is a quick one maybe you could do first, is about the birds. We were talking about the eagles, saying that the largest was the female. With the ravens, is it the same for the birds? Are the females larger?
I don't think it is on the ravens. They seem to be almost the same size, but I'm going to put that out there to the listening audience. I'm pretty sure that there are ravens who are corvids and jays and nutcrackers. The males and females tend to be the same size. That would be my guess. And as far as the wildlife corridors go, I was actually hired by the
Gordon Moore Foundation.
Foundation in 2008. I flew Gordon around and pointed out wildlife corridors that the foundation could possibly purchase to link some of these areas together in the San Francisco Bay seven counties. And
by the way, as long as we're talking about beautiful things to see, did you see his estate by any chance? I mean, it's like going into another country, you know. And I mean, it's really quite beautiful. Of course, you might imagine. I did a thing for International Wildlife concern there, and it stays in my memory as being literally like entering another country.
Oh, no, but he did show us where he grew up along Davenport, which is in a quite modest place, you know, and he was a very nice man. At any rate, so what's happening, Arlene, with the fragmentation of our habitat is that there's no gene flow between organisms, and so you have an isolation that can occur, and through time, essentially, the organisms may fail to thrive, and so the idea is that you have the ability to move back and forth. It doesn't have to be a flow of animals, but it has to be a flow of genes at least, so that the gene pool can stay pretty diverse. And so I think wildlife corridors are a great idea. I know in Southern California they've built some little tiny causeways, if you will, for desert tortoises to get underneath the freeway, which is, you know, a small amount of money for a charismatic organism.
Arlene, thank you for the call, and good to hear from you. I mentioned Michael with the wife deathly afraid of whales. We'll get him on now. Michael, go ahead.
Good morning to you both. My wife and I are actually from Sewanee, Tennessee, which is beautiful hiking country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But anyways, she's deathly afraid of whales for some irrational reason. Imagines them like crashing into the bedroom, just fears their very presence. I've tried playing whale song to her. I've, you know, gotten some coffee table photography books of whales. And I mean, I don't really know. Have you encountered this before? I think the term is cetophobia. But,
cetacean phobia. Yeah. So you're playing whale songs to her and you're showing her whale books? Sounds like you're torturing her to me.
Well,
you should move back to Sewanee, Tennessee. You know, there's hardly any whales there, you know.
That's true. That's true.
No, I've never heard of this, and it's outside of my discipline. So I'm not sure what to do. There is something called immersion therapy.
Did she read Jonah as a kid? Or maybe
she
you
did.
Could look at the origin of this phobia, where it came from. Yeah.
I have no idea, and I've never heard. I have had people go on trips that had a fear of deep water, which was kind of interesting. But never
encountered anybody with a fear of whales. Well, good luck, Michael. Sorry we can't come up with an answer for you, but maybe somebody can, and if they do, they should write us, email us, and we'll try to help your wife
out. I mean,
out.
I'm kind of joking about it, but if she has a serious phobia, you know, then I'm sorry for her.
Yeah. I hope you can remedy that in some way. Thank you for the call. Getting some questions about coyotes. Rachel says, a coyote has been spotted around my neighborhood in Menlo Park. My neighbors are freaked out, and I think it's no big deal. Who is right? And then another listener, Fari, wants to know about the importance of coyotes to the ecosystem. So maybe we can take those one at a time.
Sure. I mean, you know, Rachel, I'm kind of on board with her. I mean, I think the neighbors may be freaked out because if they have cats that they let run wild, the coyotes, I know, they often will feed on small domestic animals that are let loose. And my opinion about cats is that they should be kept indoors all the time simply because they kill literally billions of birds every year, wild native birds in the United States.
The feral cats especially. You
know, well, even domestic cats, if they're let out, they kill lots of wildlife. I forgot what the estimates are for how many billions, and I'm talking billions of birds killed every year in this country through domestic cats, not ferals necessarily, but domestic ones. So if your neighbors are concerned, it's legitimate about their cats. And rarely do coyotes attack human beings. They keep a low profile. So I wouldn't, I think in the answer to the question is you're kind of both right, depending on your point of view.
Go to another caller up in Michael Ellis country, Santa Rosa. Paul, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I've got a couple of questions. We had a couple of things. First of all, there's been a number of bear sightings in Sonoma County this year, which is quite unusual, I think. I'm wondering how common coastal bears are north of the bay. And my second question is regarding egrets and blue herons. Mm-hmm. Ever since I can remember, there have been quite a few. I've seen quite a few snowy egrets and blue herons here in Sonoma County, and I'm wondering if there's a reason for that and if they're also common in the rest of the bay. And finally, I work in the vineyards, and there's been quite a few rattlesnake sightings this year, and I'm wondering if there's a reason for the number of sightings this year.
Well, Paul, thank you for all of those questions. Before we get to bears and blue herons and rattlers, I want to get to something else that I saw on your website. You were raving about Annandale State Park, which is up there in the North Bay, is your favorite place. Why?
Well, that's because it's close to my house, and so I can bike right from it and ride my mountain bike around it, and it's 5,000 acres within, Santa Rosa's kind of sprawled out, so it's a really sweet park, small, heavily used and heavily loved by everybody. So basically it has to do with proximity to where I live.
Let's get to his questions, though. He wants to know about bears and egrets, first of all.
Well, I think the bear sightings have increased, but they're very infrequent. Of course, they get a lot of attention whenever a bear shows up. Now, historically, of course, there were bears everywhere in California. Lots of the bear valleys that we're referencing are referencing grizzly bears, which, of course, were extirpated in California. And the last one was shot in Horse Corral Meadows, Tulare County, 1924. And my understanding is that very bear is stuffed in the Oakland Museum. But the black bear, which is what Paul's referencing, is found everywhere in the United States where there's forests, basically where there's trees. And so historically there were lots of black bears, around here. And so I believe my guess is, and I'm not a wildlife biologist, but my guess is because of the abundant fires that we had in Lake County, that a lot of the wildlife was pushed out, including bears that could flee the fire. And so they probably came, and probably a juvenile male is what it was, also moving out of its natal territory because usually, there's already an occupied male in there. And once the adolescent males are of reproductive age, they're driven from the group. That would be my guess. Snowy egrets, great blue herons, they have a huge distribution through the Americas. They're very extraordinarily successful. Anytime there's wetlands or like great blue herons, for example, they also feed in the dry areas, and they seem to be doing quite well. The Audubon Society in the eastern United States was formed originally for the express intention of protecting the few remaining nesting sites for the egrets because the plume hunters were killing them all for the ladies' fashions. If you remember Miss Kitty in Gunsmoke, she always had those nice feather hats. And so the Audubon Society.
She was a madam, you know.
Oh, she was.
That's what
they
say.
What do you think, her and Matt were a couple?
I mean, no, about that, but she was a madam. The women who ran saloons were almost all men.
Oh, that's true. And vineyards, the rattlesnakes in the vineyards, good. We only have one species of rattlesnake here. It's a North Pacific subspecies of the western rattlesnake. They function in the ecosystem. They're beneficial. They eat a lot of rodents. I think it's
– So be kind to your rattlesnake.
Well, and, you know, it's nice that there's rattles that they let you know that they're there. That's thought to be an evolutionary adaptation to the presence of hoofed animals like bison, that they evolved the mechanism for warning. So that way, don't tread on me and you both can live another day.
And here is Elizabeth. Elizabeth, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi. My husband and I were in Maui, on the coast of Maui, at the very beginning of April. And we were sitting outside on our little deck there, probably around 11 o'clock at night, and we heard these sounds, and we were both so startled, and it sounded like what I have heard recordings of whale calls. And we heard splashing, and, you know, so it indicated to me that the animals were above the water. But I was wondering, do they call above the water, or were we hearing sounds from beneath the water? It was, we were just so thrilled by the whole thing. But we didn't know quite what we were hearing.
Well, good for you, and how nice that is. Yeah, those were male humpback whales singing, essentially. And they normally vocalize underneath the water. I've been on whale watching boats where we've had hydrophones where you can lower them into the water and really listen to them. So you were lucky that the sounds were carried above the surface. But normally what they're doing is competing with one another for access to females. That's what us male mammals do. And they're doing it by vocalizing and spending a tremendous amount of energy singing these songs. Now, a song, by definition, it's a series of sounds that can be repeated identically. So the humpback whale songs can go along as 17 minutes long, which is really remarkable, the kind of brain capacity that it would take to remember a song for 17 minutes. And they evolve through time, apparently, as well. And if you remember, in the early 1970s, I think, there was a little tiny record that came with a National Geographic from a guy that was first recording the sounds of the humpback whale. And if you played that on 78 speed instead of 33 and a third, it sounded exactly like a bird vocalizing. It was super cool. And so they might have been and they're not only giving birth in Maui that time of year, but they're also mating. And so maybe the splashing that you heard might have been some successful copulation at the surface, which would have been thrilling.
Well, you talk about mammals, including sapient species, as doing this kind of singing or whatever. Your present bride, did you do that kind of romance singing, country western out of Tennessee? Or?
No. You have other ways of showing fitness as a human being. It's usually like fat wallets and, you know, a big house and nice cars.
Let me read some more comments. Dante says, I just want to put in a mention of Mono County and the Mono Basin Valley. It's tremendous and not many people visit there. And Chris writes, one amazing creature we have in California now is a northern gannet. It's the first ever record of a gannet in the Pacific Ocean ever. It was first spotted around the Farallon Islands in 2012, and I was lucky enough to see it on Muir Rock off the Devil's Slide Trail late last year.
Yeah, and as I said, I do trips to the Farallon Islands, and we saw the gannet and the blue-footed booby and the brown booby all on Sugarloaf Rock, which was a really spectacular sighting. You know, so it's for rare bird watchers, that was a highlight. And lots of brown boobies this year out at the Fairlands.
And we're going to Half Moon Bay next. John, join us. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I grew up on the beach, near the beaches of Southern California, and I noticed there were squirrels all up and down the coast, right close to the coast. And I know there's a ton of squirrels across the Bay Area, but in the Half Moon Bay beaches around here, I'm curious as to why you see no squirrels.
Well, I would suspect that you could see the California ground squirrel or the beachy squirrel, and I'm not sure if there's been some agricultural changes to the landscape that have wiped those animals out. The western gray squirrel is normally associated with fruit-producing trees, forest, and things like that. The flying squirrel we don't really have in the Bay Area. And there's been a number of introduced squirrels. The eastern fox squirrel has been introduced into California, and you see that one thriving in Walnut Creek and Sebastopol, which is a non-native squirrel. Then you get up in the Sierra Nevada, of course, you got the chicory and or the Douglas squirrel. But I can't really answer that question, but you notice I shifted the question so that I did answer something that I knew something about.
Well, you gave a lot of information, but what are the squirrels we normally see in the urban area?
Well, like I said, the western gray squirrel is the native squirrel here, and the California ground squirrel is the one that you see that excavates the burrows in the ground on hillsides, grassy hillsides. That's the one that has the fleas that occasionally carry bubonic plague, so that's the ones you have to – don't feed the squirrels. And then there's the eastern fox squirrel, which is a pretty reddish squirrel, pretty good size one that's, as I said, been introduced accidentally into the East Bay, Walnut Creek, Concord. I've seen it in Sebastopol. Even in Marin County, I've seen them.
Let me thank the caller, and Lee writes, it's a good year for osprey at Heron's Head Park in San Francisco. This morning I saw an adult and recently fledged juvenile osprey fishing. A kestrel was hovering while hunting, too. Some shorebirds are beginning to arrive. Willet, black-bellied plover, sandpipers, too. Take your binoculars, and we'll take more calls. Let me go next to Fremont. Lori, you're on.
Hi, I'm talking about the Merced Wildlife Refuge, where you can go for go in the fall there for waiting for the migrating geese. It's a spectacular sight to be standing in the midst of all these huge birds that cover the sky that come in and land in that marshland. They grow corn there just to wait for them, of course, and what a spectacular sight it is to go there and watch them come in the fall.
Oh, thank you for that, Lori. Michael?
Well, no, I was going to also mention Sacramento National Wildlife Refuge and Gray Lodge. It's really spectacular. And just a plug for hunters and fishermen, that's where the money comes from for all those wildlife refuges.
So, yes, I know that. Yes, yeah. But it's an amazing sight to see them all come in. The whole sky is just covered with white birds coming in. You can see them coming in for miles using a scope, you know.
Yeah, and it gives you a sense of the fecundity that once was in California. You can still witness in the fall and winter, as you said.
I've witnessed that, and it is a beautiful sight. And it brings up another question, which neither of us probably is capable of answering in any way, and that is, we did an hour on Pokemon Go, and the woman called in and said, I was in Golden Gate Park, and there was these beautiful geese, and it was at Lake Merritt, I'm sorry, and there was beautiful geese, and the kids are just looking at their smartphones, you know, and she said, look, Canada geese, don't you see them? And they looked up for about a minute, and then they're right back to their smartphones. I mean, you've spent so many years really nurturing a love of nature in people that you communicate infectiously because you have it to such a great degree yourself. How do you get kids to be more interested in nature? I mean, you've been an educator. Maybe you have some light to shine on that?
Well, you know, there's lots of organizations in the Bay Area that are looking for volunteers. Audubon Canyon Ranch is one of those who they have a program starting now, a two-year training program, which is really great, which, you know, they actually take children 9 to 11 on these field trips. And that, I mean, you have to introduce them to it. I think there's an innate love of nature that is weeded out, but it comes naturally.
Weeded out by television?
Yeah,
and
media, and seduced by other kinds of activities. And I don't really have an answer to that question. The adults are the same way. I mean, it's not just the children. The adults are, you know, doing the exact same things on their phones. You know, I've had people, selfies. I don't know how many people have killed themselves taking selfies in beautiful places, you know, who could be thinking of it as improving the gene pool. I'm not sure, but, you know, they have to not breed first.
Darwin didn't know about that.
No.
Here's Jason. It says, twice in the last month in Golden Gate Park, I've seen a red-tailed hawk take down and eat a seagull. And is cannibalism among birds like this common? If not, why are they doing this?
Well, wait a minute. Okay, you got a red-tailed hawk, which is one kind of bird, and a western gull, which is a different kind of bird. And so I wouldn't call that cannibalism. Cannibalism is when you eat your own species. Like, for example, you're a mammal, Jason, but you eat cows, I guess, and so that's not cannibalism. That's
he may just be a vegan, you know.
Yeah, he could be. But that's not unusual. And, you know, for some people that don't like gulls, they're thinking more power to them. So, you know, Jason, I think that the red-tailed hawks are taking advantage of the resources that are nearby. So good for them.
Here's Ann from Mill Valley. Ann, join us.
Hi.
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 Hey, Michael, it's nice to talk to you. My husband and I have actually been on some of your hikes, and they're fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
So my question is, I've been running around Tennessee Valley and Mount Tam for years, and I'd never seen a bobcat before. And then about a month ago, I saw a bobcat right at the entrance of Tennessee Valley. And the next day, I saw one up on Mount Tam, so two in 2 days. And I was just curious. I wanted to know more about the bobcat population in Marin and if there was anything going on that suddenly I would see all of these bobcats about a month ago out there.
That's a good question, and that's your totem animal, by the way, obviously, if you saw two within a short period of time. You know, the they did a study, and I haven't been able to find this study years ago about the bobcats in Tennessee Valley. You know there's a trail there called the Bobcat Trail. You know that, right?
I do know that, and I've never seen a bobcat on it.
Yeah, there you go. When the coyotes moved in, you know, I think that they started competing with the bobcats and, of course, mountain lions as well. And so I think this is speculation on my part, but I believe the bobcat population probably decreased a little bit in that area versus what it was 15 or 20 years ago. And I know I've had good karma seeing bobcats. I've seen, like you have, just within the last couple of months.
Well, you talk about the totem. There's a whole kind of, Native American, indigenous people's notion of sighting different animals like bobcats and what it might mean in terms of your destiny and kismet and all those kinds
of things. Yeah, and, you know, we're in the Bay Area and she's in Marin. I mean, you know, of course, it has to be something significant. But, you know, I think what it is just good luck on your part, and just, you know, they're furtive animals, they're secretive, they're mostly nocturnal, and so you just had there you're probably not an increase in the numbers of bobcats. It just happened to be what we call observer bias. You happen to see them, and that, just think of it as good fortune.
And thank you, Ann. Let me try to squeeze in another caller here. This is Liza with an important question. Liza, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a fascinating show. I am calling because I have a 6-year-old boy who's just obsessed with nature, and I was wondering what kid-friendly adventures you might suggest, Mr. Ellis.
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I know, I have a North Bay bias. I hate to say that, but I know that the Point Reyes Educational Center has a summer camp for kids, a nature camp. I started that with Don Neubacher, who's now the park superintendent of Yosemite, back in the early 1980s, and it's continuing to go to this day. And so it's a week-long camp, and it will he's a little too small for the sleepaway camp. But I know the organization I work for, or as a volunteer on the board, is Land Paths. We do a summer camp for kids that's day long, and that's really great. I bet Hidden Villa down south does too, and I bet you there's a lot of people out there that have better ideas than I do.
Is there a hike that's good that comes to mind?
Oh, anything. I mean, you know, you don't even have to go very far with a 6-year-old. And the beautiful thing about 6-year-olds is they're seeing things in a new way and give you a new insight into the world of nature. So the fun thing about being with small children, or any children for that matter, is they have a different perspective and different point, and they will start looking at things and give you a new vision and a new way of seeing the same thing that you've just kind of glossed over through time.
And there are programs now that take kids out of the inner city and out of areas that are essentially impoverished and bring
Slide
them out
Ranch.
To nature. Slide Ranch, good example. Thank you, Michael. Always good to have you here. Footloose Forays, they're online, and we've been talking with Michael Ellis, naturalist, wilderness guide, and the king of Footloose Forays. Thank you for joining us. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Scheffer-Wolf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. Thank you for listening. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.